Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Philosophy, a podcast channel with the New Books Network. I'm Alexis McLeod, Associate Professor of Philosophy and Asian and Asian American Studies at the University of Connecticut, and I'm co-host of this channel, along with Robert Talese, Carrie Figdor, and Sarah Tyson. I'm joined today by Malcolm Keating, Assistant Professor of Philosophy at Yale NUS College in Singapore. He's here to discuss his new book, Language, Meaning, and Use in Indian Philosophy, An Introduction to Mukula's Fundamentals of Communicative Function. All right. Well, Malcolm, thanks for joining me today to talk about your book, which I really thought was great, by the way. We'll talk a bit about that down the road. But first, I wanted to start out by asking if you could tell us a bit about how you came to philosophy and Indian philosophy and the topic of this book in particular.
Sure. So I came to philosophy in a little bit of a roundabout way. My undergraduate education was a double major in English and Spanish literature. I was sort of interested in philosophical questions around literature, interpretation, things like that. I went on and did a master's in philosophy at the University of Missouri, St. Louis. And while they don't have necessarily a program in Indian philosophy or Chinese philosophy there, I took a course, just a single introduction course, where I was introduced to Indian and Chinese thought as I was studying philosophy of language more broadly in the analytic tradition. And I found Indian philosophy interesting in a couple of ways. I found it interesting as a conversation partner with the analytic philosophy and the Western philosophy quotes that I was learning, but I also found it interesting in itself and in how it had sort of some practical, sort of transformative implications for thinking about questions in philosophy of language and philosophy of mind. So I got just a little bit of a taste of it during my master's program and thought that it was something that I wanted to pursue more seriously. So I turned to the study of Sanskrit. I did some Sanskrit, just a little bit as a graduate student at large at the University of Chicago before I went on to do my PhD at the University of Texas at Austin. And it's there where I was studying in particular with Stephen Phillips in the philosophy program there, but also studied a little bit with Larry McRae, who was on my dissertation committee. Cornell, folks in South Asian studies, Patrick Olivelle was there before he retired, and some others. So it was there that I really started to dig into Sanskrit philosophy in earnest. And as a lot of people, I started out interested in Buddhist philosophy. It's sort of a hot topic for analytically minded folks. But I was really interested in questions about pragmatics and metaphor. And those are not thematized to the same extent as they are in what we might call the Brahminical literature, the literature that is focused on thought developed from the Vedas, Vedic thought. So with Stephen Phillips, I started to read other thinkers. So for instance, Abhaya Dikshita, who's a late, you might call him a poetic or aesthetic theorist, that drew me into Mimamsa, which we can talk about a little bit, but they're you might call them hermeneuticists in some sense. They're concerned with interpretation, but also philosophical questions around language more broadly. And basically, I was drawn into the work of Mukula through that sort of path, looking at Abhaya Dikshita, Mimamsa, Alankara Shastra. And I encountered Mukula. You know, it was a little single monograph that only really, you know, Larry McRae had written on at that point, and not a lot of folks had been thinking about him, especially not philosophers who were mostly concerned with, you know, sort of Buddhists and Nyayakas. And I just thought his approach was really interesting. It was, as we can talk about, not necessarily Buddhist, Nyayaka, Mimamsa. He was sort of a broad interdisciplinary thinker. So I got grabbed by his work. But it, like I said, it's a little bit of a circuitous route. but that's how I wound up becoming interested in Mukula.
That's really interesting. So Mukula, where does he kind of stand in terms of like the traditions that you mentioned in Indian thought?
Yeah, so there are a few ways to characterize him. So one, of course, is his time period. His date is in the late 9th or early 10th century in Kashmir, so the north of what's now India. And that the people that are working on that geographical sort of context and their influences from Buddhism, Shaivism, and things like that. So Mukula was sort of in that mix of people. But he, at least in this one work that we have, which is all we have of him, he doesn't identify himself as, for instance, a Mimamsaka, someone who is focused on Vedic hermeneutics and ritual thought. He doesn't identify himself as a Nyayaka, what you might consider a logician, the term people often use, or a Buddhist, or a grammarian, although he does draw from a lot of these sources. So one way to think about these genres is that you have what's often called philosophical literature. People call them the darshanas, or the viewpoints. And so one way of characterizing these darshanas is that there's traditionally six of them. So you have Samkhya and Yoga, Mimamsa, Vedanta, and so on. Which one am I forgetting here? Nyaya Vaisheshika, excuse me. So these are often the subject of philosophical inquiry for contemporary philosophers, because they, as it were, have their philosophical questions a bit on the surface, right? They're thinking about things like, does the self exist? What are the basic constituent parts of reality, and so forth. You also have a genre of grammatical literature. So Patanjali and Panini are two of the major thinkers there. Panini is well known for his reflections on the grammatical structure of Sanskrit. And Patanjali, who writes a commentary on his 8 chapters in Rashtrajati, he reflects a bit on the philosophical questions about reference. What is it that words refer to? So in the grammatical literature, although there's a lot there that's really thinking just about the Sanskrit syntax, structure of Sanskrit, there's a philosophical, strong philosophical thread throughout that literature. In particular, people will probably know the name of Bhartrhari, who is a grammarian but also a broadly philosophical thinker, far beyond just Sanskrit syntax. And then there's a third sort of genre that you might think of as influencing Mukula, and this is what's known as Alankara Shastra. Shastra meaning the science of discipline, and Alankara meaning sort of ornamenting or making beautiful. And so this is a genre which is concerned in particular with poetry and the ornaments of poetry, so things like figures of speech. But they're not just concerned with cataloging figures of speech, they're concerned with thinking about the way in which we understand the content of poetry, how it influences our emotions, the status of fictional characters, things like that. That's all found in Alankara Shastra. So Mukula, in a sense, stands among these three genres. He even mentions them in his work and draws on all of them. And so one of the things that I was trying to do with this book is to show that each of these genres, these sort of categories of textual tradition, as it were, are properly the subject of philosophical inquiry by contemporary people. We should be looking at them, and that they are as it were, philosophical in their right. own right.
One of the things I thought was interesting, you noticed you talked about how Mukullas' thought has been somewhat neglected, and I thought when I read that, so there's I work on the Chinese philosopher Wang Chong, and it's a very similar situation, and he was neglected, but horribly neglected, and I think the mm-hmm. reason for him was that he didn't really have a team, right? He didn't have a camp. There, you couldn't use his views to argue for the Confucians or the Taoists or something like this. Mm-hmm. Do you get the sense that mm-hmm. that's for the reason behind Mukullas' neglect, mm-hmm. or is there something mm-hmm. else going on, you think?
Well, so I'm hesitant. So I think there's two things, first of all. One is who is he neglected by, and in what sense? So I think when we're thinking about contemporary sort of European, Anglophone, broadly Western, although I certainly don't want to leave Japanese Indologists out of this, study of Indian philosophy is global, but when we're thinking about contemporary treatments of pre-modern sources, I'm not sure that I want to ascribe a particular reason to a neglect of a particular thinker, given that so much of Indian philosophy is yet to be investigated. I mean, we don't have translations of seminal figures. So I think for one thing, you could just say, well, look, Mukullas is one of many, many people whose works ought to be studied, but we just don't have enough people working on them. So that's the sort of modern situation. I do think, though, that it is fair to say that when you think about philosophy, and you think maybe philosophy of language, if you have any acquaintance with Indian philosophy, you might think, oh, well, let me go to Nyaya philosophy on theories of reference, or let me go to Buddhist philosophy on apoha or exclusion. It's not the case that most people are going to think about Alankara Shastra because they may not even know that it exists, depending on your training. So I think that might be fair. As far as the history of Indian philosophy, pre-modern sources, I think Mukullas' thought wasn't neglected in so much as it was absorbed. So we see Mukullas' thought in particular in the work of Mamata, a later Indian thinker in the Alankara tradition, and he draws on him extensively. So I think people just they drew on it and they moved on. And I think also Mukullas' view became a minority position. He, as we'll talk about, argues that Anandavardhana, this great seminal thinker, was wrong to argue that there's a new kind of semantic capacity. He's conservative. He thinks that we were fine where we were. And in Alankara Shastra, broadly speaking, most people went along with the view that that third capacity was necessary. So that might be another explanation for why Mukullas' work, which is just one single small text as well, wasn't picked up on in the same degree as maybe.
One thing I wanted to mention was your translation was fantastic. I thought it's one of the clearest translations I've seen recently of a Sanskrit work. And one of the things that kind of struck me as I was reading through it was just how kind of difficult some of the Indian texts, especially in philosophy of language, are to access. So even for those of us who have some Sanskrit, kind of the Sanskrit texts are hard, and then looking to a lot of the translations makes it even harder sometimes. Right? So I wonder, like, how did you, is this a function of the text? Is Mukullas' text a clearer text, or was it your particular translation choices, or how did that process happen?
Well, so just in terms of the Sanskrit syntax, I wouldn't say that Mukullas' text is one of the more complex texts, just in terms of the structure. So I think that's fair to say. I mean, there's certainly some terse and difficult sections that are I comment on that I'm not quite sure maybe what he's meaning by this word or that thing. And because the text is so short, you have to make some choices. So I think that's definitely some of it, that his work is a short, fairly straightforward, grammatically speaking, text. However, that said, even works like that, because of the particular structure of the Sanskrit language, for instance, propensity to have long compounds and embedded relative correlative clauses in longer sentences, when one translates in a way that leaves the Sanskrit syntax sort of on the surface of the English syntax, I think that can be very helpful for a specialist to see the choices that you've made and how you're understanding the text. But for someone who is coming to the book just to understand what Mukula is saying, what I tried to do, and this is just on the basis of my experience reading with other people, I mentioned in my book, Stephen Phillips, and Parmo, Bill, and Larry McRae, you know, we all talked about this text, that splitting up sentences just has to happen sometimes when you're working with a Sanskrit text. So you might have a sentence that runs several lines in Sanskrit. If you were to unpack that into English, it would be probably doubled or tripled in size once you make clear the relationship between, for instance, parts of a compound. So in English, you know, we say fire truck, right? And that means a truck which is for fighting fires. Well, we all know what fire truck means, but essentially the analogy is that in Sanskrit, when you come to something that says fire truck, you have to expand it. Is this a truck which is made of fire, a truck which is for fighting fire, right? All these sorts of things. So that lengthens your sentences just by making that explicit for the reader. And then when you have a sentence that starts out, that thing which ... several compounds, that same thing it ... several compounds, it just gets very long. So I intentionally chose to split up sentences into shorter sentences while trying to preserve the meaning. Because what I hope will happen, and you know, we'll see what people think who read the book and who know the Sanskrit, but what I'm trying to do is preserve the meaning of Mukula's text while making it something that a philosopher who doesn't have much, if any, experience with Indian philosophy can pick up and read. You know, they might be a little bit puzzled at some places, but that they could get the sense of the words.
I think that's a great choice, and I think it helps a lot with, you know, for people who are coming from kind of a more philosophical background without Indian thought, because it's really impossible. I mean, even for some of us who have some understanding of Indian thought, just pick up some of the text and really understand what's going on. So I think it's a great choice that you made, really clear. So one thing I wanted to mention is the structure of your book that I found really interesting. How you have the historical introduction, the translation, the transliteration of the Sanskrit, and then extensive commentary on that. I mean, one of the things it reminded me of as I was reading it reminded me of the structure of some of the classical Indian texts themselves. It looks like, and I was wondering, did you intentionally mirror that, or why did you pick this particular way of introducing Mukula's thought?
Yeah, so I think it is fair to say that by reading so much commentarial literature, I have been influenced by the commentarial structure. But I actually think that's a good thing, because what the Indian commentators do, and I'll just note here, we don't have a commentary on Mukula's text, so essentially
this is the one.
I'm commenting. I'm acting as a commentator on his text. At least that I know, if we don't have any. What the commentators do is they, Janardhan Ganeri has talked about this sort of commentary as an intervention into the particular context that the commentator is in. So what even classical Indian philosophers are doing is they're picking up what the original or root text is saying. They're explaining it. They're explaining how things hang together in that original context. But then they are bringing it into connection to controversial issues of their day. So I think in a sense, there's a way to understand commentary as philosophy, right? It's not just footnotes or remarking on something. It is a kind of philosophy. I think what I do and philosophy in general is whether it's the work of Bertrand Russell or the work of Wang Zhang or the work of Mukula, in a sense, what philosophers are doing is they're trying to understand what thoughts came before them. They're trying to engage with objections to that thought. They're trying to modify that thought. So that's the sort of thing that I take myself to be doing in the book. But I think really it wasn't intentionally that I'm trying to mirror a particular genre. Like I'm trying to be a contemporary commentator on Mukula so much as what I wanted to do with this book is I wanted to ensure that there are sort of multiple points of entry for Mukula's text. So I do want people who don't understand Indian philosophy at all to be able to pick up this book and come away with it knowing something more about Indian philosophy. And for that to happen, they have to know something about the players. They have to know something about the problem. And so they're going to need to know the conceptual context, the textual context, things like that. For people who are specialists, you know, they're probably just going to skip my introduction, maybe skim it a little bit, and they're going to look at the maybe the commentary, how I interpret Mokulo. They're going to look at the text. And frankly, you know, they might just look at the transliteration and some of the choices that I've made in terms of splitting up compounds and things like that. So the hope is that this text is something that even if people can read Sanskrit and they could read Mukul's text without my translation, that there's something in there for them. And for people who can't read Sanskrit, there's something in there for them.
Right. And I think that I like the way that you did the commentary there. I mean, it's kind of an introduction to Indian philosophy in a different way as well, because it introduces to a kind of way of writing commentaries, right? That's not as familiar in the West, which is, I think, great.
Yeah. I was just going to pick up on that a little bit. So this is something that I've actually given my students as assignments when I'm teaching Indian philosophy, but I think they found it helpful for other contexts where I say, okay, well, I'm going to teach you a little bit about commentary, how commentary works. I want you to write a commentary on the section that we've been reading. You know, identify what's the purpose of this section in light of what's come before it in the context. Define some terms for me, raise an objection and defend it. All those are, these are things that commentators do. And so I think, you know, even though maybe we don't have a self-conscious tradition of commentary in, for instance, the analytic tradition, like there have been in other times and places, I do think that there are a lot of things that contemporary philosophers are doing which fall under the functions of
referencing other views, things like this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I wonder, could you say something about the particular philosophical concerns that led Mukula and other Indian philosophers to have the kind of concerns with language that they do, especially his concerns with language? Was it grounded in ethical concerns or religious concerns or concerns of, as you mentioned before, poetry, things like this?
Sure. So what I would say is a couple of things. So I would say that for what I was calling Brahminical thinkers before, so people for whom the Vedas are kind of the touchstone of both their cultural activities, their sort of self-identity, their religious practice, things like that. For them, the Vedas and the interpretation of the Vedas, the interpretation of these texts, that's important. That is certainly one motivation for a concern with language that you find in Sanskrit philosophy broadly. You also find in early texts, like in the Upanishads, you find discussion of the creative capacity of language. You have the idea of language as something that brings things into existence. So it can be in a particularly religious sense in the way that a command, a Vedic injunction brings into existence the desire to perform a ritual. It can be in the context of mantras, sort of repeated sayings which bring things into existence. It can also just be in the sense of trying to think about testimony. So how it is that you can come to have knowledge on the basis of someone's telling you something, for things that either you haven't seen or you're not in a position to observe. So all of these are reasons that Indian philosophers are concerned with language. And they're concerned with it from a lot of different angles. I'd say for Mukula, while he certainly does talk about the epistemological function of language in the beginning of his text, and he talks about the idea that unless you have some confidence or certainty that your words pick out things in the world and that there's a relationship between the word and the reference, you're not going to be able to go about your activities, right? You're not going to be able to go get the things. I mean, just an ordinary example, you know, someone gives you a grocery list, unless you have confidence that you have a relationship between the word and the referent, how are you going to go out and get the things on that list? So Mukula is concerned with this epistemic aspect, but really for Mukula, he's not writing just about for instance, testimony or Vedic injunctions or things like this, he is really concerned with this question about poetry as it relates to these other things. So it seems like poetry also causes us to have, if not knowledge, it causes us to have cognitions, right? It causes us to have mental events. So we come to imagine, entertain, have understandings of the figures in the poems. And so there are interesting questions about how language in that context fits with language use in these other contexts. And so one of the things that I see Mukula is doing is saying that language in both these Vedic contexts, in these ordinary contexts, and in these poetic contexts, this is all language. And we should be able to give an account of all of these different uses of language that's more or less unified. So we see him hinting at all of these other concerns, but his concern is really to respond to an argument that was specifically about poetic language.
So this distinction that you talk about, that Mukula makes and others about primary and secondary meaning, you talk a little bit about how this looks like, and I found interesting the connection between this and sense and reference. And I know there was a couple of places that in the text where you talked about the dangers of putting bringing too close together kind of conceptions that we have in analytic philosophy and then what was going on in early India. But to what extent were those close, and what was the primary and secondary meaning distinction that they were getting at there?
Yeah. So the basic way that I would explain primary meaning versus secondary meaning is that the primary meaning of, we'll talk about the primary meaning of words, is that the primary meaning of a word is its reference. So, and we can talk about in a moment what those different references are. There's lots of philosophical discussion about that. But what you need is the same, I would say, so you use a word like cow, or ordinary examples in this context. And there needs to be, from different instances of that word, different contexts of that word, where that word is used, there needs to be something shared that word refers to in order for us to explain how it is that we are able to acquire the sort of capacity to use words. So the idea is that the primary meaning is the referent of a word that is in common among all of its different uses. Now, secondary meaning is also understood in terms of reference. So one of the things about Indian philosophy, broadly speaking, of course, speaking of academic cases and generalizations, but I'll just say as a generalization, most Indian philosophers thought about meaning in terms of reference, at least early on. Buddhists, there's some important exceptions to this, and things get more complicated later on. But the primary meaning of a word is its reference. Directly, I say cow, you get the reference, for many thinkers, it's the universal of cow, or some it's the particular cow, etc. But in under certain conditions, you can have indirect reference. So if I say cow in the context of a metaphor, on the basis of the primary referent, you come to have understanding of the next thing, the indirect reference. So one way you can think about it is sort of two stages cognition, even though we're not necessarily aware of that. So the reason, and so the thing I would say is that the language causes this cognition of a referent, and the primary meaning causes it constantly, directly, in all cases. The indirect or secondary meaning comes up by means of that first understanding, and it only occurs in certain conditions. Now, this is not exactly, I would say, the same thing as the sense reference distinction. Contemporary and modern analytic philosophy, and again here just to generalize it, you can think of a sense as a way of cognizing a reference. it's not about a second stage of cognition or an indirect reference. Now, the point that I think you're hinting at in my book is that while Mukula doesn't think in terms of, I think, what we would consider sense references, there are places in the text where he talks about what I've translated as semantic imbuing, maybe a little sort of a lot packed in there, but the Sanskrit term is uparakta, and it just means something like colored or shaded or tinged or something like that. And so there's a, under some condition, in some context, in light of the primary, let me put it this way, we can understand something in light of something else. So for instance, if I say, under some conditions, the village is on the Ganges, this is a common example of secondary reference where I don't mean the village is directly on the Ganges. What I mean is that the village is right up next to the Ganges. So in some contexts, I'm basically just trying to say, look, the village is on the bank of the Ganges. The fact that on the Ganges, which in Sanskrit is a single word in the locative case, the fact that I say on the Ganges, well, I'm just picking out the bank of the Ganges because it's just right next to the Ganges. But I'm not thinking of the bank in terms of the Ganges in any way. It's just, you just look, they're right next to each other. It's not impacting my cognition of the village insofar as it's on the bank of the Ganges. But what Mukula says is in some cases, the Ganges, which is the primary referent of on the Ganges, that comes to influence the way that we understand the village. So, and this is something maybe like connotation. So the Ganges in the Indian context is a holy river. And so if you say the village is on the Ganges under the right kinds of, in the right situation, and we can talk about what the situations are, you would understand the village as basically being a very, maybe a holy village because it's right next to the Ganges. And so that's the distinction between primary and secondary reference. And the idea of semantic imbuing is something like sense, but I want to be real careful and say it's not exactly.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So one thing that I found really interesting was this idea that the primary meaning of a word like cow, something like this, could be a universal, and that a particular referent, like a particular cow, would have to be through some implied or secondary meaning. Does Mukula associate, so he has this concern with poetic meaning, as you were talking about, does he associate that meaning with the kind of secondary meaning that the use of cow might have if it's meant to refer to the individual? Why does he make this move of taking words like cow to primarily indicate universals rather than particulars?
Yeah. So again, this is one of the controversies that Mukula touches upon in his text, but he doesn't spend a lot of time developing, but it is a discussion that, for instance, if you look in the Nyaya Sutras, the Mimamsa Sutras, or more specifically the Shlokavartika commentaries on those texts, you'll see a lot of discussion about this. It's also in the work of the thinker that I mentioned earlier, Patanjali,
right.
Grammarian. So So there is this discussion about what is it that is the primary reference of a word. And what Mukula says, and here he is drawing on Patanjali, for instance, as well as some engaging with Mimamsa or hermeneutics. What Mukula says is there are different kinds of words. Like there's nouns, there's action words or verbs, in other words. There's words that are adjectives, and there's names. So we can characterize the syntax of our language, right? Characterize it in different ways. What he says is that these different kinds of words have different reference. So for him, he says that nouns, their primary reference is the universal, whereas action words, their primary reference is something which is to be done, something that is yet to be done, and so forth. And so properties refer to, adjectives refer to properties which already exist, and names refer to, names sort of refer to things as they are contingently denoted. They're not picking out a feature of the person, right? So I'm Malcolm, but that doesn't refer to any sort of essential thing about me. It's just a contingent fact. So like you're Malcolm. So what Mukula does is he says there's these four categories of words, and they have four different primary reference. And this is really following Patanjali here. But the idea that nouns refer to universals, I think one, there's a few ways to motivate this idea. And I think one of the ways to do this is that if you're talking about something like cow, you are talking about primarily something's being a cow, right? So you're talking about, if I say cow, I'm referring to the nature of something being a cow. I'm not referring to a particular cow. And why is that? Well, for one thing, you might want to say our use of language needs to be able to account for commands. So for instance, you say, I want you to go get a cow. If a command were to refer to a particular cow, once someone has fulfilled that command in the sense of getting that particular cow, you can't fulfill that command again. Right? So this is coming from the sort of Mimamsa ritual context where you have these commands, go get this kind of thing, go do this kind of thing. And the idea is you need to be able to refer to something which precedes in existence these individual things. So of course this is a view that gets criticized by other thinkers, but notice here that what Mukula argues is this isn't to say that we're unable to refer to the particular cow, Bessie or Flossie. It's just that that's a secondary function. It's insofar as a cow, Bessie, has a relationship with cowhood, that we're able to use the word cow to pick out that particular cow. And so in the right context, when I say, go get the cow, and I think one little footnote here, before I finish my sentence, one little footnote is that we might in English think, well, that's at least in part what the use of the definite and the indefinite article is for. Well, in Sanskrit, there are no definite or indefinite articles, although there are certainly pronouns which can play a similar role. So what we have is the word cow, and we have to understand, well, how is this being used? Is this being used in the generic sense, in a particular sense, and so on? So it's a matter of the context of the sentence that helps us, not just helps us, it determines what the reference of that word is. So when Mukula says there's a relationship between the primary and secondary meaning, when there is an obstacle to understanding the primary meaning, in that case, so you're able to understand that cow is meant in its secondary sense. And there also has to be a reason for your speaking that way. So if I'm going to say, go get a cow, and I'm actually meaning a particular, as opposed to a general, you know, cow type thing, you have to be able to attribute to me some reason for using the word in this sort of derivative secondary sense. So this is how Mukula explains that, yeah, nouns primarily refer to universals, but this doesn't mean that we don't all the time use nouns to indirectly refer to particular things. And it's the philosophers that notice this. You know, ordinary people don't reflect on this. We don't notice these things, but it's the philosophers that are able to tell us, well, actually, this is a secondary capacity.
One thing that I thought was interesting, you talked about relatively early on in the book, that you've got this kind of third mode of signification or meaning, right? You've got the primary and the secondary, and then there's there's something, suggestion, which Mukula rejects. Could you explain this controversy about suggestion and why Mukula rejects this category?
Yeah, that's right. And I think this is one thing that's important to keep in mind as we're talking about Mukula, is that this text comes in after the work of Anandavardhana, who is this another Kashmiri thinker who predates Mukula by maybe about 100 years or so. And he argues for what you're characterizing or calling suggestion. It's the word dvani in Sanskrit. And dvani, I mean, a recent translation that I really like, Larry McRae has translated this as resonance. The meaning of dvani in its very literal sense is something like the reverberation as you might have of the sound of a drum or something. And so dvani is the idea that when you, for instance, talk about the village on the Ganges, there is a resonance, a suggestion, something else, as of the village being holy because it's next to the Ganges. And what Anandavardhana argues is that we need to have this third capacity of language in addition to the primary and secondary, because we can't account for what poetry does without it. And so let me explain that, and then I'll get back to Mukula. So the idea is that, as I mentioned, there are these three requirements that aren't new to Mukula, but these are fairly standard requirements, that when you have an incongruity of the primary meaning, when there is some kind of relationship between the primary and secondary meaning, and some kind of motive to understand the secondary meaning, then we have the secondary meaning. So if I say the village is on the Ganges, and you think, well, literally the village can't be on the Ganges because that would mean the people would be drowning in the river. But villages, the next to the Ganges River is a bank. So there's a relationship of contiguity or proximity. Oh, and why would you speak that way? Well, maybe shorthand, right? You just want me to know that the village is right up next to the Ganges. So then I can say, okay, what's being indicated or given by secondary meaning is just insert the words on the bank of. But what Anandavardhana says is, well, look, that accounts for that additional meaning. But when you say something like the village is on the Ganges, and you say it in order to convey the holiness of the Ganges, you don't have an explanation for that meaning that comes along as well, that sort of resonance or that suggestion. And that's not a matter of these three characteristics. And so he has a whole very long text. So like I said, Mukula's text is rather short. Anandavardhana has a quite long text, the Dvanyaloka, where he discusses this. And he says, he gives all these examples where he says, look, you can have this suggestion or resonance without secondary meaning. You can just have a straightforward, so in poetry, you might just have a description of someone, and that might suggest certain things. You can have this sort of resonance in addition to a particular figure of speech in a poem. So if we think about Shakespeare, for instance, use a Western sort of English example, Shakespeare has this long, you know, all the world's a stage, we are merely players, and so on. You could analyze the individual figures of speech, individual metaphors in that soliloquy. But what Anand of Ardna would say is there's a further suggestion of a larger metaphor that is not reducible to just those parts. So, and the most important thing I would say for Anand of Ardna is that he has this sense that what poetry does is it causes people to have an experience of what's known as rasa. Rasa means something like, literally, it's something like flavor or sap or like the juice of a like plant or something. But it just means a highly aestheticized kind of emotional experience. So if you, I don't know, to use another Shakespearean example, you watch Romeo and Juliet, you don't have an experience of love, right? You're not in love with Romeo or Juliet or any of the players, but you have a sort of aestheticized experience of love. And what Anand of Ardna says is that rasa, that is a kind of meaning, and that is a kind of meaning that can't be accounted for in terms of just the primary meaning. I mean, if I say, I wrote a poem and I say, this poem is about love, that's not going to cause you to have that experience. And just the particular metaphors, those don't have as their content this aesthetic experience. So this is what Anand of Ardna argues. And Mukula is arguing against that. He says, we can, if we broaden our notion of these three criteria, we can account for even rasa dvani, that is the suggestion or the resonance of this aesthetic experience in terms of secondary.
That's interesting. I wonder, do you think that that Mukula's solution there is kind of fits better with a kind of contemporary context and philosophy of language than, because it seems like people might be more willing to take something like that on.
Yeah, so it's funny. So Anand of Ardna is quite fun in some places. So he takes up some potential objections. He lives before Mukula, so he's not thinking of Mukula per se. But he has this long section where he discusses whether rasa and rasa dvani or dvani in general, resonance suggestion in general, can be known by inference. And so he's of course thinking here of the anumana, which is a very specific maybe subtype of what we would consider as inference. But anyway, he gives some reasons to think that, you know, inference is not going to get us this thing. And at a couple of points, he just says, you know, you logicians, you're not in any kind of position to understand poetry. You know, so I just think, you know, if he met an analytic philosopher today, he might be like, what are you doing? You're dissecting this thing, you're giving these sorts of analysis, but you're missing the suggested sort of resonant meaning. And that's not a matter of logic, right? Now, it's not in Mukula, but in Jayantabhatta, who's a Nyayaka or a sort of a logician, he has a little section where I think he's taking a swipe at Anand of Ardna, and he basically says, people who don't know anything about language say this. You know, people who take themselves to know stuff say this. So there seems to be a little bit of a tension here between the sort of epistemologically, logically inclined thinkers and people who are engaging in particular with poetry. But what I would say about Mukula here is that whatever you think of Mukula's solution, and it is a short text, so I think, I tried to expand on what I think he's saying there, but it's a fairly brief text. Whatever you think about his view, he does at least go through examples of poetry, some of which Anand of Ardna himself used, some just other examples, and he tries to give an account of how it is that secondary meaning, lakshana or indication, can get us these suggested meaning. And so he's at least taking seriously poetry alongside of these other uses of language as something that needs to be grappled with philosophically. So now I think the one thing that contemporary philosophers might say, and I think indeed have said, is that this discussion starts out with a presupposition, which is that things like rasadvani are artha, or meanings. Now, depending on your understanding of meaning, you might just say, like, you know, Davidson, or more recently Ernie Lapore and Matt Stone, just say, well, look, there's all kinds of interesting psychological things that go on when we read poetry and when we read metaphors, but it's just a category mistake to call them meanings. But here Mukula is taking on seriously the idea that this is an artha, this is a meaning, because it is something that arises out of our understanding of the language, understanding of the poetry. And with that presupposition, then he has to give an account of how it is that we come to have that concept.
One of the things that I thought was interesting that you did toward the end was to kind of bring in the comparative aspect and talking about kind of comparing Mukula to some of what's going on in contemporary philosophy. And there was one point at which you compared Mukula's views to those of Francois Recanati, and you said concerning what is said in a statement, which was interesting. You discussed a syncretic view that he mentions that he ultimately rejects. I wonder if you could say something a bit about what that view is, and is this something like, do you take this to be something like what's going on in Mukula? Sure.
Yeah, so let me back up a little bit before I dig into that and just to talk about this idea of the sort of comparative philosophy that I was trying to do in the book. So one of the things that I really wanted to do in this book was not to say Mukula solves a particular problem already found in contemporary analytic philosophy. What I was not trying to do with this discussion was to say, well, look, Francois Recanati and other people who are, you know, the relevance theorists and others who are discussing pragmatics and semantics and the boundary between them, they've identified a really important problem, and here's how Mukula can pose either an alternative view or strengthen an existing view. And I intentionally do that because I think what I want people to do when they read the book is to come back to their sort of own projects in philosophy of language or wherever, and maybe be able to think about it maybe in a new way. So I'm a bit agnostic in the book here about whether I think Francois Recanati has things right in his analysis, or that the problems of the semantic pragmatic distinction in contemporary analytic philosophy are well put. I mean, it's a huge literature on it, for one thing. But so what I was trying to do at the end of the book is to just give I would say suggestion, as it were, to the reader of ways that you might be able to think about Mukula's work in light of some of the issues in contemporary philosophy. So that said, one of the things that I found that was interesting is that Mukula has this little discussion, again, brief, sort of schematic, of how it is that we get from the primary meaning of words all the way up through what is fully expressed in the context of an utterance. So you can talk about the reference of words. You can talk about what the word indicates or conveys indirectly in a secondary manner. You can talk about how words together in combination in a sentence express something. And you can talk about how sentences themselves indicate or have a secondary meaning at the level of the entire expression. And so Mukula has a little section, and I won't get into all the technicalities here, where he tries to take on board different views of sentence meaning, how it is that we come to have a unified cognition from what you might think are just a list of words with their corresponding reference. How does that construe into a unity which gives us a cognition of a state of affairs? And so he seems to put forward his own view, which is a syncretic or combination of other views on offer, where one way to understand it is something like the word has its primary function. And this expresses something sort of at a very minimal level, like cowhood, right? And that from that, from cowhood, you can get the an indicated meaning. And what happens is that that indicated meaning is part of the process of that discrete set of words becoming a sentence meaning. So the idea is that just a bunch of words on their own are going to give the ordinary primary reference. When those words come together into the context of a sentence, indication functions in order to sort of constrain the referent of those words. And then a further process can happen where you can have another additional indicatory function that takes the sentence as its whole content. So in other words, it's not just that the word Ganges gives rise to on the bank, but that a whole sentence, for instance, poetic metaphors, for instance, can give rise to something further. And so the connection here with Recanati is that François Recanati, so he's a contextualist, and he basically has tried to, in one of his books, he defends contextualism, so the view that the meaning of a word is basically always contextual. So there is no really helpful right. sense in which we can understand the meaning of a word in isolation from its use. And so in the course of his explaining his view, he identifies as what he calls syncretists. So for instance, people like Kent Bach and others, people who say, well, look, what you have is you have an utterance of some words and you have a sort of semantic interpretation, which gives you a sentence meaning. And that sentence meaning may not even be something that is truth evaluable or propositional. It's just going to be something like a bare minimum. So I'm thinking here of a case, for instance, red. The word red, you might say, has a minimal meaning, which is just something like redness, right, the property of redness. But when you use the word red in a sentence, sentences are going to be true under different conditions. So I could say the table is red, and the table is red when it's painted red on the outside. But the conditions, the truth conditions for a bird is red are different on this view than when I say a table is red. Because for the bird, a bird is red when its wings and body are just red in color, but it's not when it's painted red, right? And so you can get these different truth conditions that correlate to these different meanings of red. So the idea for these syncretic theorists, as Recanati calls them, is that you get something that's sort of underdetermined in terms of the truth condition. And then a later necessary semantic process, which they call saturation, gets us something which is a sort of a minimal truth conditional propositional content. And then you have other what we would call pragmatic processes, things which go beyond the level of just the minimal proposition that we need for it to be truth evaluable or propositional. You can then sort of enrich, sort of make broader or narrow the senses in context. And then even further than that, you can have an optional sort of pragmatic process that gets you not just what a speaker has said in its full sense, right. but sort of what they've communicated, what they've implicated with the content of what they've said. So that goes, it's going very rather quickly, but the basic idea here is that in contemporary analytic philosophy, there are people that have this theory on which we have these different levels of words and sentences expressing their meetings. And in some way, this seems to map on ways on the way that Mukula's view tries to take into account all of these different processes which get us the primary meaning of a word as well as something beyond it, both at the level of the word and the level of the sentence. So that's what that last chapter is about. But like I said, the goal is to say, look, here's some interesting connections. But I conclude by saying, sort of giving a little warning, like, okay, before we go off and say, look, that Mukla or any other Indian thinker has said exactly what Kent Bach or Francois Recamonti has said, let's think back again about the context. So I kind of close the book by reminding us about the original context, and the hope is that that might help us sort of think differently about contemporary.
Absolutely. I mean, the kind of asking new questions, right, when we see the different contexts and the different kinds of philosophy that are being done in India and China and elsewhere, I think is really important. And that's something I think your book can really help help in with contemporary philosophy.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the hope. I mean, honestly, so the book is out there. I think what pre-modern Indian philosophy can do for contemporary philosophy, you know, I'm in some ways I'm a little bit agnostic on that, because I think there's a couple of ways that looking at these texts can be helpful. And one is at the level just of having people think broadly about philosophy, having people think broadly, I mean, just in the context of philosophy of language, thinking about different languages, thinking about different sort of linguistic datum, as it were, different poems, bits of speech, and how other people have thought about it. So I think there's a lot of different ways in which this pre-modern philosophy, whether Indian or other, can be helpful for things that we're concerned with right now. Not the least, to push back sometimes on our fixation on a particular our question, maybe. We look back and we say, well, why are they so caught up on this? Why are they so concerned with this question? And sometimes, you know, I think, well, let's try and flip that a little bit. Why is it that we're so concerned about looking at things in this particular way? So that's
great. So what's next on the horizon for you? What projects are you working on now?
Sure. So I have one thing sort of in the pipeline, as it were. So I have an edited volume on Arthopathy, which we didn't get a chance to mention, but this is another piece of Mukula's thinking that he, I think, identifies a particular epistemic instrument of the pramana. So perception and inference are paradigmatically two of them. This one's called Arthopathy, and he, I think, it's implicit, but it's pretty much there in his text. He thinks this is responsible for how it is that we come to know these indicated or secondary meanings. So as I was thinking about this this idea of Arthopathy, which I haven't found a really nice translation for it, but some people use presumption, some people use postulation. It's the idea that there's something that you need to postulate or posit in order to account for some obstacle or some obstruction. So, you know, if you think back to the idea of secondary meaning, one of those three criteria for secondary meaning or indicated meaning to function is that there's an obstacle. And so the idea is that when there's an obstacle, the thing which we use to resolve that obstacle is the secondary meaning. And Arthopathy broadly is a means of knowing which allows us to know things on the basis of these different kinds of obstacles. So by looking at Mukula on Arthopathy, I got really interested just in Arthopathy in general. And unlike, say, perception and inference, which have gotten a fair bit of discussion, Arthopathy's it's not one of the epistemic instruments that I think has been really discussed quite a lot, but it has implications for our thoughts about inference, for our thoughts about logic and so on. So there's an edited volume in the works where I've gotten a bunch of really awesome Sanskritists and philosophers together to do translations of really seminal texts on Arthopathy, some of which haven't been translated before, and then to close that off with some essays, some of which engage directly with the text in the volume, many of which engage sort of with one another and with contemporary philosophy. So should be out in another year is the hope. So that's the project that's just been finished, save for final edits and such. The one that I'm working on now is a new one, is about a mimamsaka, Kumarala Bhatta. So he's a very important early, you might say Vedic hermeneuticist, but he's a philosopher who takes as his starting point reflection on the Vedas and their interpretation. His thought about language and epistemology is really important for Alankara Shastra, this tradition of aesthetics. And so he's a couple of centuries before Mukula. So I've been actually just the past couple of weeks, I've been digging into a chapter in the Shlokavartika, or expansive verse commentary that he's written on the Mimamsa Sutra, the sutra text, where he talks about how we come to know similarity. And so what I'm thinking about now for this next book project is the relationship between how we come to know that things are similar, how we come to use that sort of similarity judgment in metaphor, how we use that in analogical reasoning, and things like that. So the core of it, I think, is really the upamana, or the comparison chapter in Kumarala, but it branches out into these other questions about comparison in other.
That's cool. So that's really great. Any chance of a Shlokavartika translation sometime down on the road? We really need a good one.
We do. So I've been reading the Upamana chapter with John Tabor. Actually, that's what I've been doing, working on my translation. And it is possible that I'll have a translation, maybe in an appendix to the book or something like that. But I think we do. We need more translations of all of these texts. And, you know, I think the thing about these translations is that none of them are going to be the final word on any of these thinkers. So we have Jog's translations, which, you know, they're really important translations, even if they have, you know, maybe he's got some mistakes in it, but it's essentially Jog is we've got his kind of commentary, in a sense, on Kumarala, because we understand how he's interpreted Kumarala. We need to have other people doing that, and doing that for different audiences. So I have my translation of Mukula. Johannes Bronckhorst has another sort of section of Mukula in a Shabda reader just out. I'm hoping other people start picking up other Alankara thinkers who get pieces of Kumarala. So we can just get more and more people reading these texts and maybe using their thought in various ways in their own work, or being sort of interested to explore more.
Definitely. Well, I want to thank you, Malcolm, again for joining me to talk about your book. It's a great book. Everybody check it out, Language, Meaning, and Use in Indian Philosophy. Fantastic book. Thanks again, Malcolm. Thanks. Talk to you later.
Great. Thanks a lot. I appreciate your time, Alex.